Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is the third of these director's dialogues. The first, if you remember, was with George Soros. The second was with Susie Orbach. There was going to be one with Joschka Fischer, which he had to cancel because he had to go and chair the UN Security Council. But he's promised that he'll come at some point in early April, of course, depending on what happens in the wider world. I'm very pleased that Javier Solana was able to come today. Javier was originally professor of physics at Madrid Complutense University. After moving into politics, he held a succession of cabinet posts in the Spanish government from 1982 to 1995, including Minister for Foreign Affairs. From 1995 to 1999, he was Secretary General of NATO. Since October 1999, he is Secretary General of the Council of the European Union and is in charge of common foreign and security policy for the EU. Javier is at the vortex of world affairs at the moment. And I'm so grateful to him for coming. This is the second public discussion in a way we've had, because I went to Barcelona where we had a panel discussion publicly about at least some of the issues that we're going to cover today. But it's extremely generous of him to come and honour this commitment, because everybody knows this is something of a global crisis going on. Javier is in the middle of this global crisis, so initially would you please give him a very warm LSE welcome. I thought where we'd start is not with the Middle East initially, where we will get to, however, but with the current situation in European politics. And I'd just like to talk to you a bit about what your view about the future of European social democracy is. A few years ago, most people here will know, 13 out of 15 EU governments were ruled by left-of-centre coalitions or left-of-centre parties. Now that number is down to about 5 or 6. There is a massive return of the right in Europe. You have the rise of a populist far right in Europe as well. And of course you have Mr. Bush in the US, a switch from Democratic presidency to a Republican presidency. Now, how it seems to me is that there isn't, as it were, a massive ideological shift underlying this transition, because some of the changes that have happened in Europe and elsewhere have been a result of the fragmentation of the left. I think you could say we would not be in the situation in the world we are today if Ralph Nader had not decided to stand against Al Gore in the US, because that was crucial in George Bush's victory. But the same thing has happened in Europe. In Italy, the left fragmented, whereas the right managed to unite. And the kind of reductio ad absurdum of that was what happened in the French presidential elections, when the left simply fragmented on the first vote, and as a result you got this runoff which nobody particularly wanted. So there are some contingent factors, but it seems plain also there are ideological ones, and these are related to the rise of the far right with themes of insecurity, immigration, crime, and I think some kind of fear of globalization, because I think there is a kind of polarization of politics between, as it were, the new far left with the rise of the anti-globalization movement on that side, and the rise of the far right, who are also, but for very different reasons, very hostile to this larger cosmopolitan world which is being created. So I don't know if that gives you some kind of springboard to give us some views.
I would try, Tony. Let me start by thank you very, very much. I have been a professor of theoretical physics for a long part of my life, and I can tell you that never have been received as I've been received today. So thank you very, very much for your warm welcome.
Well, we like to treat our visitors well, don't we, the LSE community? Well, I think it's an indication of people's interest in world affairs that we've got such a massive audience. I was saying to Javier beforehand, we could have sold the tickets three times over for this event.
Well, thank you very much. Again, it's a great pleasure to be in this
this technologically primitive environment.
In this important academic place in the world, in London. I mean, Tony has asked me to talk a little bit about the European Union and the left. Let me start by saying that I've been all my life a social democrat. I was born in a family of social democrats, and I hope that I will die as a social democrat. I believe in that. I think that this is an ideology that makes the balance between the values that I like to defend, that I think are the basic one: freedom, solidarity, compassion, that beautiful word that exists in English and is very difficult to translate to other languages. Now, but you asked me about the social democracy in Europe. And I think it's very difficult to answer that question, because I think that the cycles of political life in Europe do not exist for the moment. I think that exist cycles of political life in the different countries of the European Union. Mm-hmm. But I think it's difficult to talk about the political cycle in the European Union as such. You see, when a country begins to move into the left, but the other country that begins to move to the right. And it's very difficult at this point in time. And that has consequences. And I think it has consequences because it means that we don't have still a European public opinion as such. We don't have a citizenship of Europe that reacts to the same manner, to the same policies, or to the same situations in the world. And it's something that we have to fight for, and it's part of the debate on the construction of Europe that I think is fundamental. I believe that in the construction of Europe, what important thing is to have real citizens of Europe at the same time that are citizens of their respective countries, and we have political parties and political life in Europe which is European. We don't have yet. And I think that is a very, very important thing we have to fight for. Now, I think that the elements in which in different countries the social democracy has been diminishing in some and increasing in others. Look at the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, we had in a question of 3 months a dramatic change. Remember what happened in
Amsterdam. Amazing, yeah. Most people
and a moment in which a populist leader, apparently unknown, took
the majority of the professor of sociology. This guy
got most of the votes. He was assassinated. They have elections right after that. A tremendous sweep in the public opinion. And 3 months later, they needed again elections, and the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats practically came along with the same number of votes. So it's very difficult to say, as I said before, that it's a tendency that is European. Still, it's a tendency that belongs to the different countries. That, I think, is the first point I would like to make. And I'd say it with a little bit of sadness, because I would prefer very much to have already a political life and a political political parties which will be of a European or European nature. But no doubt that the question of insecurity, in the broadest sense of the term, is absolutely fundamental. And the leaders of the central left have to tackle these questions in an intelligent manner. I think in your country some progress has been made, and I think the reality to say that the New Labour has done important things in that respect better than in other places. I think that the French left was not able to tackle this question in an intelligent manner.
You mean, for example, the crime, the question of crime.
Right, crime, migration, etc., etc. Now, a word about migration. I just read yesterday a very good report about the future of the economy in Europe in the year 2050 perspective. And that report points out very clearly to the question of the aging of the population in Europe, and therefore the need to open the doors of the European Union to new people.
Two examples of the aging population of Europe sit before you here.
And therefore, this
still
question,
vital we are, though, eh?
This question has to be resolved. It is not a matter for the right to resolve. It's a matter for the centre-left to resolve also, if we want to have an economy that is productive and an economy that generates jobs. So the answer to that, first, I don't think that is a general tendency in Europe. We cannot consider Europe that has political tendencies still collectively. And second, I think, as you said, and I agree completely with you, that the populism, threats to the center-left, as far as voting is concerned, are very much linked to security, understood security in the widest sense. And I think we will talk about that along the session.
Yes, because that lies behind lots of things going on, I think, in a broader sense. But I think if we just briefly consider the Pim Fortuyn phenomenon, the Dutch phenomenon, because there you had, in many ways, what seemed to be the most effective social democratic consensus in Europe, because you have very high employment, very low unemployment, a consensual way of doing politics, a pretty successful society as it would look to most people from the outside. Everyone talked about the Polder model, you know, the Dutch model, and then zapped out overnight. It's true that the Social Democrats have got back to much like the position they had before, but I think the phenomena underlying this, the insecurity of the population, people's reactions, whether they're right or wrong, about immigration, crime, and also, crucially, about the European Union. Because a lot of people in these sectors of society are now, I think, very hostile to the idea of the European Union. There is something there which is quite deep in politics, and I see it in every country, really, because it's linked to a certain disaffection among, you know, a substantial proportion of groups, I think, in society, with the whole political process and also with the... I think with what the wider world is doing to our societies, they feel the world rushing in on them and they want to defend identity, and immigration is one way in which they respond to that.
Well, I hope very much, for instance, I mean, to bring to another example, which is not the example of the Netherlands, which has been so important and so worth studying. I do think that in my own country, maybe a change from center-right to center-left now, when the tendency seems to be, the global tendency seems to be the other.
Well, it was the other way around before, wasn't
right?
it, when you were in government?
I mean, there are countries that go out of pace, and that is a reality of Europe, that is very difficult to find a moment in which all of the different political parties which are in power belong to the same family. This is probably never has happened.
But if you take the issue of immigration, Harvey, I mean, can the Social Democratic left get a decent position on immigration, which will respect liberal values, but also allow the left still to do well in elections? Is that possible?
Or is I think it should. It must be possible. It must be possible, and I think it's possible to do it. I think that we have to be able. You have to be able to respect, as you have said, the two elements. One, we need new people. We need not only. To help the poor people in the world to get a better place, if they do so want that, but also we need it from the point of view of our economic, to maintain our economic system. But at the same time, that has to be done in such a manner that doesn't create insecurity and at the same time losing the trust and the confidence of the majority of the people. But the difference between the United States and Europe, as far as migration is concerned, is very clear from the economic point of view, to my mind. In the United States, you have a migrant that comes and it has no rights in security, social security at all. So it's somebody that enters into the country. If he has a job, he has a job. If he doesn't have a job, he doesn't have a job. Nobody cares about him, etc. In the European Union, we have a certain sentiment of compassion. And somebody that comes to our country, we treat them in a more decent manner. And therefore, it's more costly. And that is the one of the problems that we have in order to have the productivity. I'm not telling that we have to change that, but we have to do it in such a manner. And it seems to me, from what I know from the rest of the world, that the model that is more appealing to my mind at this point is the model of Canada. I think Canada has been able to find an equilibrium between what is the traditions of the United States.
And
the classical models of the.
Don't know whether you're laughing approvingly or critically, but I think Canada has actually has been most successful as an immigrant country of any country.
Integrating minorities.
Which got a lot more space. So.
Beautiful.
Shall we go on to the issue of the EU itself? Because I mean, I think there is this worry about people deserting the European Union, and the European Union is trying to respond, not just to rightists who want to overthrow it, but I think to more general worries about the progress of Europe in two ways, as I would see it. One is economically, by trying to get Europe as competitive as it could be, and hopefully get somewhere near to getting to overtake the US, perhaps economically, which is essentially the Lisbon agenda and the follow-up to the Lisbon agenda. And the other is the European Constitution, an attempt to make changes that will make Europe more democratic and therefore in some sense closer to the people, the sort of famous democratic deficit argument, if that is valid. I'm not sure it is valid myself. Can we talk about the first of these? Because over here, I was just mentioning before we came in that most people here might have seen in their papers the Treasury issued a report very critical of the European Union overall in terms of its levels of competitiveness, its labour market flexibility, its productivity in relation to the US, and suggested that Europe has not really implemented the Lisbon agenda, has not therefore generated enough jobs, and is likely to continue to lag indefinitely behind the US. I mean, you must have a lot of views on this, I think, because to me, if the European Union is going to be successful, it won't be primarily through the Constitution. It'll be primarily through whether or not it does things that people want, which is, above all, help generate jobs and produce economic prosperity with solidarity and social protection.
Well, I am a very, very much pro-European, so I am not a Eurosceptic. I believe in Europe, and I believe that what we can do together in the European Union is much better than we can do in a separate manner. Economically, I think that the Lisbon agenda that Professor Guinness has mentioned has to be implemented, and it has to be implemented with much more vigor than has been up to now. The fact that we have the most important economy of the European Union, which is about 30% of the economy, which is Germany, practically at growth zero, with problems of very, very, very structural dimension, is a very bad manifestation of the problems we have. If the most important economy is going that way, that stops the rest of the countries to grow. Therefore, I think the transformation that you have mentioned on the labor market, on liberalizations and all these things, that can be done, it should be done. It should be in the agenda of any center-left political party, should be implemented and rapidly. One of the things that, to my mind, the European Union does have as an inconvenient, and I would like to see change, is that the rhythm at which things take place is too slow. The Lisbon agenda is old, and it takes a long time before the decisions which are taken in one council are implemented to the next. I'd like to say that the unit of time, if I may say, of the European Union is the month. Nothing happens in between a month and another month. A European Council meets a month, and until the next European Council meets another month, nothing happens. I mean, life today, the unit of time in which in the world we are living today, is not a month. In one day, you can have a join between two important global companies and change completely an industrial sector of the world life. And we cannot respond to that. So I think that one of the important things that we have to do, related to what you have said about applying the Lisbon agenda, is first have the will to do it, and second, have the will to do it rapidly, at a rhythm that cannot be the rhythm at which we move. The European Union is too slow in animals in movement, and we have to make moving faster in that direction, which is the correct. The Lisbon agenda, nobody has any doubt that is the correct one. But the moment that begins to be the moment of implementing is the moment in which it is not produced at the speed and with determination that, to my mind, it is necessary.
But I mean, can I press you on that? Because you can see such big problems with that. Because you said before that European nations have their own momentum, and this is true economically. I mean, how is the German economy going to become dynamic? Because Mr. Schroeder has quite a decent reform program, but it's extremely hard to get it through, partly because of the unions, partly because of other kinds of institutional stasis in Germany. And many people have said that Germany could become like Japan, and this is not, I think, an inconceivable scenario, kind of frozen, and with that large chunks of the EU economy become frozen. And then you've got France, which, you know, France says, well, we're not going to implement chunks of the Lisbon process because, you know, if you see it from the outside anyway, you know, we want our companies to be able to invest in Europe, but we don't want other companies to be able to invest in France. So, you know, you seem to have a lot of barriers to this actually being realised. So it's hard to see how you can mobilise on a European level the way of overcoming them.
I think you have pinpointed one of the problems. I mean, let me say a word about Germany as I see it. I think that the present political situation in Germany and the manner of what the economy can be handled, the fact that the results of the two last London elections had been the result that was well known by everybody, makes really the government of Germany as a cohabitation, to use the French terminology. And that cohabitation between the Bundesrat and the Bundestag, therefore the government, is linked now to two. We have to find agreements with the Christian Democrats practically in all the important issues of the economic reforms. That probably will have some beneficial consequences in order to transform some of the most difficult parts of the economic life or the structural life of the German economy or the German society that has been so difficult to be produced. Now let me go to France. It is true that in a moment in which the Lisbon agenda was tried to be applied, was the cohabitation in France. And some of the reforms, for instance, in privatizations, were very difficult to come across. Now, this brings us to the same question that Dr. Giddens asked at the very beginning. Since we don't have the same political cycle, sometimes we have more difficulties because we are not a country, and therefore we have to be sometimes wasting a little bit of time because of the lack of being in the same path the different countries that belong to the European Union. This is going to continue to happen in the process of enlargement. I mean, we're going to get another 15 countries in the European Union. Let me give you two figures so you have an impression. These 15 countries are going to join the European Union are more or less, if they were a country, they will be about 100 million people, a very big country. But if you look at the GDP of that considered as a country, we'll have the GDP more or less of the Netherlands, which are 15 million people. So we are going to have to do a tremendous effort with the process of enlargement also, to mobilize the resources, the energy, to construct a European Union which is, from the economic point of view, as solid, as productive, as job-creating, as innovative as the thing we have to do. I think we have three basic pillars that we have to transform. One is we have mentioned before, the population. A second, some of the structural reforms. And third, innovation, research, technology. In innovation, we could do way much more than we are doing, and that the universities is absolutely fundamental. The human capital, the intellectual capital that we have in the European Union put together, the number of universities, in research centers, etc., put that together, if we could coordinate better the efforts and the resources that we have, no doubt that we could have a society much more innovative than what we do today. And that is something that we have to think about very seriously.
Yeah, I think for that you really need a limited number, you know, five or six super universities for Europe. Actually, I think the main problem over universities is a bit like the rest of Europe. There is collaboration, but it's actually very difficult. There's not much movement of personnel between university systems in different countries. You've got Erasmus programs and that kind of thing, but universities are still pretty nation-bound, I think. You know, Europe doesn't have anything really compare with the kind of top level US universities in terms of scientific innovation, not as yet anyway, I think.
I tend not to agree with you on that. I think that the level, the standards of the universities of Europe are splendid. And it's difficult to understand, if that is the case, as you said, that the change of I mean, if something is free to move, it's science, it's knowledge. There are no barriers for that. Maybe barriers because of the language, but practically, in science, in knowledge, English is the lingua franca, so this it shouldn't be any difficulty to create really a compact European Union as far as intelligent knowledge, etc., is concerned, and innovation, therefore.
Well, I think
that is something that I would like to do when I abandon that job, and and I hope that you will continue doing.
Well, yeah, when I abandon my job, which is pretty soon.
We will do it more or less at the same time.
There should be about 5 or 6 super universities, and the LSE should be one of them. That's my opinion.
No doubt about that.
But I mean, I think the result of this is that everyone can see that there are still very, very big barriers to European structural reform, and the mechanisms for achieving some kind of catch-up with the US seem to me to be still pretty formidable. What about the Constitution, Javier? I think that the
question of the Constitution, you know that we are now in the so-called the Convention. One of the important issues is the Constitution. It used to be the Constitution. It was supposed to be the Constitution. From the moment in which the UK government accepted the Constitution as part of the reforms of the Convention, I think the Constitution has not, it's not any longer the big subject. And the Constitution, we want to have it short. I think it was Jack Straw who said that a good Constitution should be put in your pocket. You should be able to wear it within your pocket, and it would be quite an important achievement if we do that. The things which are really important on the Constitution is if we can distribute properly the competences of nations, the European Union, and the regions, the three levels. I think this is a very difficult question to do. The last constitution in Europe that has been done separating this is probably the constitution of my country, and it's a very difficult constitution to apply sometimes. When you want to go very clearly in division, what corresponds to Brussels, what corresponds to London, and what corresponds to the regions of UK. It's a very difficult thing, but I hope that we will be able to do something constructive on that. But I don't think that the question of constitution, if we try to avoid some nominalisms, avoid terminology, which is offensive for some, but it doesn't really mean much, I think we will be able to come up with something which is reasonable. But on the convention, I would like to see that for me is not the most important thing, the constitution. Is not the most important thing, the institutions, the architecture. I think what is more important is the political will to do things together. We will come later on to the question of foreign policy in the European Union. We may have the most important structure, the most important division between different institutions in the European Union. If the political will of the different countries doesn't exist to put to work together, you may have the most beautiful institution and it will lead nowhere. And that is what to me is important, the political will to be able to put in common some of the basic policies that we have to put in common if Europe as a whole wants to play a role in the international arena, and I think we have the obligation to do it.
Well, yeah, I must say I agree with that. I think that, I mean, political scientists have to make distinction between two kinds of democracy, representative democracy and discourse democracy. Representative democracy is how you have a mechanism for voting linked to a constitution. Discourse democracy is the open discussion of public issues and problems. And there is a speech, I think, being given here today at the LSE, or was it yesterday, by a professor from Harvard who's arguing that the European Union is actually much more democratic than many people, especially critics, tend to say. And I think this is true, because if it's primarily a discourse democracy, it's primarily a way of solving problems together in an open fashion. I think most of the mechanisms of discussion in the European Union actually are pretty transparent, and more transparent than those of quite a few of the nations which actually make up the European Union. So I think this business of Europe being undemocratic can easily be overdone. And in the end, people's disaffection with Europe isn't primarily with that, it's primarily a lack of economic performance and those sort of on-the-ground issues which I think we have to improve. Well, can we move on at this point to the issues which I'm sure most people have come here to primarily hear Javier talk about, which is first of all, relationship between Europe and the United States at this point in history. when we had our previous discussion in Barcelona, we started off by talking about the thesis of Robert Kagan, who has achieved great prominence in international relations recently on the basis of an article he wrote called The Power and the Weakness. That he's recently written a book to follow up on this, which has just been published, and the Sunday Times has gone big on this and has published, I think, two big excerpts from the book over the last couple of weeks. Basic theme of the book, you might, I'm not sure how far the audience will know, but is essentially that those that can do, essentially, if you can do something, you will do it. Well, Europe has, according to Kagan, created a kind of postmodern universe of relative harmony beyond the old military adventures of the past. The US, on the other hand, has to bear the burden of having military power on which Europe and the rest of the world depends for some kind of stability. And so Kagan says each side tends to give a kind of rhetorical flourish to its own position. Europe is militarily weak and therefore stresses collaboration, multilateralism, international organizations. It's got its own civilizing mission. Its civilizing mission is to export the model of Europe as collaboration, a peaceful collaboration above the level of the nation. Whereas the US is forced to live in a much more Hobbesian world of power. And Kagan says that Europeans are in bad faith in some degree on this because they want to criticize the Americans, but the prosperity of Europe would not be possible without American military power, because American military power protected Europe, he says, from the Soviets, and Europe couldn't even resolve its own internal problems in Bosnia and Kosovo without the very substantial use of American military force. And this thesis has got enormous amount of attention in intellectual as well as in practical discussion. So what's your opinion of this?
Well, you have described very well the thesis of the intellectual in the United States. I tend to disagree with that approach, although I have it has some merits. I tend to disagree because I do think that this attack on multilateralism is a mistake. I don't think that in the 21st century you can do things alone. You need always to do it with others. And for the Europeans, the concept of multilateralism is not just something that came from the blue, from heaven. It's our own experience. When we didn't have multilateral organizations, and the European Union is one of them, what we had in the territory of this continent was war. Last century, we have been the scenario of two terrible wars that started in Europe and became global wars. Now, today, it's absolutely impossible to imagine anything like that taking place in Europe. And the reason for that, at least one of the reasons for that, is because we have constructed a European Union, which is a multilateral organization that is ruled by law, it is ruled by norms that everybody obeys or tries to obey, etc. I think this is a fundamental thing, a fundamental statement that sometimes the United States do not understand. Second thing, when we say that Europe doesn't have a military power in the sense that it cannot be deployable in other places of the world, we have to remember also something very simple. During the Cold War, the obligation of the countries of the European Union were to have military capabilities to defend the borders of their own country. That was the task that the European Union countries had in NATO. Suddenly, with the end of the Cold War, the Americans demand the Europeans to immediately be able to have a deployable armed forces. That is very, very different. I remember very well, I put you two examples. In 1996, I was Secretary General of NATO. In January of that year, we have to deploy the first contingent of forces from European countries into Bosnia. The Germans did not deploy forces. First, because the Constitution didn't allow them to do it, and second, because we were not prepared, because the obligation of that army had been during the Cold War to defend Germany. 3 years later, after Kosovo, the second commander-in-chief of all the forces deployed in Kosovo were a four-star general from Germany. So in a very short period of time, a tremendous process of adaptation has taken place. our American friends have to understand that they have been always an army deployable because their territory has never been attacked with the exception of September 11, and I think that's why so many things have changed in the United States after September 11, and I think that we have to talk about.
We will.
But before that, the United States, and maybe to a certain extent Great Britain, are the only two armed forces that were able to deploy. But I don't think that this thesis that we Europeans are unable to fight, that we are wimped, where the strength really lies in our friends in the United States, is true, but it's not totally true. It is true that the construction of the European Union was possible because the United States were defending Europe. There's no doubt about that, and we have to recognize that and be very grateful to the United States citizens and government at the time for that. But now I think the Europeans have to recognize that we have to make an effort and capabilities, well, military capabilities, in order to have an ally of the United States with the strength which is demanded for an ally. But I don't think, and I will not defend, to compete militarily with the United States. I think it will be a tremendous mistake of the European Union. I believe in multilateralism. I think that the United States invented multilateralism, and now the new administration are less keen on multilateralism. But if you remember the end of the Second Great War, the big multilateral organizations were created by the United States. IMF, World Bank, United Nations, now the World Trade Organization, all those institutions of the globalization that were born at the end of the Second Great War were created to a certain extent by the Americans. There's a beautiful book that I read this summer, it's a biography of Keynes, that probably many of you have read, the third volume, which is the last part of
Skidelsky,
the...
Robert Skidelsky.
It's a fantastic, very interesting book, I mean, even for somebody like me, which is a background of physics. But there you see so clearly that at the end of the Second World War, the Americans wanted to construct a multilateral world. What has happened after the end of the Cold War that... apparently, the multilateralism is diminishing in the United States, whereas the Europeans maintain our interest and our manner of seeing things in the world through a multilateral prism. This is why I think we have a beginning of a rift between the United States and the European Union countries.
The question is whether it's a structural thing, because what Kagan says, he's got this now famous phrase that the Americans do the washing up, the Europeans do the dishes. That is, the Americans intervene militarily in different parts of the world, including inside Europe in Bosnia and Kosovo and in Afghanistan and so forth, and the Europeans come along and they kind of do the business after the war has finished, and you can see there is some sort of division of labor on that line. So what Kagan says is the Europeans are free riding on American military power, but it seems to me that the US, at least at the moment, is actually free riding on the kind of collaboration multilateralism which the rest of the world adopts, because the American government at the moment, I mean, the Bush doctrine is, to me, straightforward America first doctrine, has no time really for multilateral organization. But actually the world wouldn't function were it not for the multiplicity of multilateral organizations that exist. So there's a strong element of free riding on both sides, if you like, in that relationship. But it does still seem to me a problematic one, and I take it you would agree that, I mean, I certainly agree with the idea you don't want two superpowers armed to the teeth. You don't want that. That would be far, far worse. But surely we do want the Americans to recognize that the world is much more interdependent than before, and they can't just bestride it like some kind of military colossus. And second, we want surely some more military capabilities in the European Union.
But why only military capabilities? I mean, look.
Well,
at
in
it.
Order to intervene in local situations which might serve humanitarian purposes.
I think we are beginning to be too obsessed with military action.
Well,
I mean,
it would be very nice to think so.
No, but honestly, I mean, for instance, the fight against terrorism, I like to say that the center of gravity of the fight against terrorism is not military. And it's very clear that it's not military. And we know it. And your country knows it, and my country knows very well that it's not military. Is much more important to have a good cooperation on exchange of intelligence and information, etc., etc., etc. And it's very interesting that from September 11 until now, the cooperation between the United States and Europe and fight against terrorism has given tremendous results. Tremendous results. And most of the important achievements have been done by the Europeans cooperating with the United States, but not militarily necessarily. I mean, to think that you have to measure everything by your military capability in the 21st century, I don't think that is a sign of civilization. I mean, I don't think that as time goes by into the future, the only unit of measure is going to be military capabilities. There are many other capabilities which are fundamental. Let me tell you another example, because I have lived in the last days and months. When the Afghanistan war was over, I remember I was in Washington that month of November in New York with Colin Powell and the G7. And the big city, Mazar-e Sharif, if you remember, was about to fall one day. And after that, the falling of that city, it was absolutely fundamental to find who is going to take the peacekeeping operation in Kabul. And the politically correct statement was it has to be Arab countries, Islamic countries have to be there. And we spent 2 weeks looking for those countries to appear. As you know, in Kabul, the Islamic countries that took place of the peacekeeping operation was fundamental, and it still is fundamental, were the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Spain, and Italy. That means that when the chips are down and something is needed, there are the Europeans also to do it and do it properly. And I insist on Afghanistan because I think that job has to be finished, and it's not being finished. And I get a little bit excited with this. Let me to give me an example. Look, before, let me give you a figure. The growth of poppy, of heroin, in Afghanistan. Before the war, of course, the Taliban's, well, you remember what it was that. Now, in the year that is over, the sale of heroin from Afghanistan has arrived to the figure $1.2 billion. It's cultivated of poppy now in Afghanistan after the war is over 30 times more than it was before. It's a lot of things that have to be done to finish a job. If at the end of the day we're going to have in Afghanistan a situation like that, something is not being done right, and we have to go all the way to the end. And who is doing that? We are doing it being done by you, by your country, by my country, by the European countries, etc. So we have to really.
But isn't that
put
an example of free riding by the United States?
Right,
But what I
like to send a message is that this sentiment that everything has to be measured by the unit of your military power is not necessarily. I mean, it's important, no doubt about that. It's important, no doubt about that. But I don't think that is the only measure that you can take. And this is being said by somebody who has been Secretary General of NATO and led the campaign in Kosovo. So I know very well of what I'm talking about, but I do think honestly that we have to begin to think on other elements of a balance in the world that is not necessarily only the military power.
I think also American military power, I think rapidly you get a situation of overstretch. The US will get in a situation of overstretch if it simply applies its current policy. It just won't be able to cope. And I think if you don't have a we'll come on to this in a minute, but if you don't have a multilateral alliance with whatever happens in Iraq, the Americans are going to have to foot the bill, American taxpayer. You already have massive problems in the American economy. It's not the way to run the world, I think. And I completely agree with that. There are other forms of power besides military power, and some of them are the crucial ones which can really save the world in the current age, not deploying military force. On the other hand, there is this division of labour, and what you say also reflects this division of labour. It's quite hard to see how one can get over that unless Europe can have a bit more independent military influence.
I am for that, and I am very much for the agreement and the position that UK and France have had. They had in Saint-Malo, in the famous meeting of Saint-Malo, and they have repeated the 4th of February in their meeting that France and the UK have met together. I think that this is a good decision. We're going in the right direction. But let's put the weight that is they correspond to every statement that we make.
Can I just say that we can go on with this until 2:15, which we intend to do, but if people have to leave at 2, maybe you could sort of shuffle out relatively quietly, because we'd like to come on to some of the sort of key issues which I'm sure everyone who can stay wants to hear Javier's views on. Can we just then go to NATO quickly? I mean, here you have a situation where what might happen in Iraq is seemingly dividing all the major councils of the world, the United Nations, European Union, and NATO. What does it mean for NATO? And doesn't everybody says, does NATO have a role now? What will happen? Will the Americans take out some of their military influence from NATO? They don't seem to want to use NATO anyway. So,
well, NATO, as you know, was an organization with a defensive mission. Now the enemy is an enemy which is very different than the classical enemy, and therefore NATO has to adapt itself to a new reality. Is NATO going to be able to do it? During my time we did some of it, some of the adaptation process. We took over missions of peacekeeping in Bosnia, we did Kosovo, we are maintaining the possibility of being in the Balkans in general terms. Now, we have, NATO has to adapt to be able to go what we call out of area, out of the European borders. This is a very difficult thing to do. There are countries which are not very keen on doing that. But it seems to me that the only possibility of maintaining NATO as an active role, apart from being a place where the transatlantic relationship is incarnated and the debate about security is being done, in particular now that NATO is going to multiply, it's going to increase the number of members, many of the members will not be able to have the military capabilities which are needed for the deployment that we have been talking before. But I think that, as I said before, they have to adapt, NATO has to adapt to a new reality, but I think it has a very important role to play. And if only one, to be the place where the Europeans and the Americans get together to talk about questions pertaining to security. And the other thing that to my mind is fundamental is this is the basic coalition between the United States and the Europeans. When I listen to some of the leaders of the United States, this phrase that the mission determines the coalition, it for me is a phrase that represents a negation of the existence of NATO. The coalition exists already, which is NATO. And therefore, then you can increase, or you can change, or you can put more members in the coalition. But I think the coalition exists. And when you recognize that the mission determines the coalition, I think it's giving a blow, very tough blow to the...
I don't want to mention Kagan too much, though. You could say that's an example of Kagan again, because the Europeans want to collaborate and the Americans just want to deploy military power. And that's the kind of fracture which is now at the heart of NATO, because the Americans ignore NATO when they want to.
They did, yes. They did. But NATO has used Article 5, which is the collective defense, once in their life. It was after September 11. And after having taken that decision, nobody looked at NATO again, which was really, I think, quite a mistake.
But I mean, you would agree that it's crucial to try and keep NATO together, presumably.
I think that NATO had to change, has to adapt, no doubt about that. Lord Robertson is trying to do that. But I think that the importance of NATO nowadays will be more and more and more the place where the transatlantic relations continue to be incarnated.
Well, can we now at this point move on to September 11 on Iraq and begin with the issue of terrorism? Because it seems to me that there is a real change in the world after September 11. I'd like to find out how much you agree with this, between what I call old-star terrorism and new-star terrorism. Old-star terrorism is the kind that we're familiar with, both in the UK with the IRA and you in Spain with the Basque separatists, which is local terrorism oriented towards a specific goal, which is normally national separation or national independence. But now you have something new, which is geopolitical terrorism, which is organized on a global basis, which draws on the power of civil society. I mean, people have drawn, I think, quite, if you're you won't take this too far, I hope, but quite valid comparisons between civil society organizations like Friends of the Earth and organizations like Al-Qaeda, because they're both global networks, they both operate outside the sphere of the state, They both have a sense of mission which holds the whole thing together, and they both have branches in many countries, and they both have many imitators. One of the disturbing things about what seems to be happening in the new geopolitical terrorism is that Al-Qaeda is only one of quite a diversity of groups which are targeting essentially the West. And if you look at there is an Al-Qaeda website, if you look at it, several Al-Qaeda websites actually, it seems to reveal that Al-Qaeda is not just a religious organization, it has economic motivations. Economic motivation is a bit like we were talking about earlier, to stop the process of globalization, that is to push the West out of countries around the world where the West in its view does not belong, hence the bombings in Bali and so forth by some of these groups. And also it's an agenda to sink the United States and the West economically. That's why you could argue the Middle East is a kind of cockpit for all of this, given the dependence of the West on oil. Now, we're all struggling to know how seriously you should take the threat of geopolitical terrorism. I think September 11 did not happen in Europe. If it had happened in Europe, people here probably would be less complacent than many are. But it's very difficult to work out what the strength and the impact of this threat is. But what we do know is that we're far more vulnerable to a massive attack than anyone had thought before September 11. We've now looked at the vulnerabilities of our cities. For example, London, the underground, is highly vulnerable to a terrorist attack, or other areas, which no one had really thought of, I think, as being targeted by attacks which could kill, in principle, millions of people, not just thousands of people. But how seriously do you take the threat, and how does this relate? Is there any relationship between what the Americans seem to be proposing in Iraq or not?
Well, I think that, as you said, the terrorism that we are contemplated today, after September 11, or the manifestation that was made in September 11, is different than what we have suffered. But it has also elements which are common, which you have suffered in your country, or I suffer in my country. I remember very well something very dramatic in your country, in the conference of the labor, of the Conservative Party, was blown out to the hotel in which everybody was living. Leaders of the country were killed, and so that's a tremendous impact also on the life of the country. So we have lived many, many things. I have been member of the government for 13 years, and it's strange or rare the week or the month that I didn't go to a funeral by somebody killed by a terrorist attack. So
Well, and you still have to have a bodyguard all the time.
Right. But I distinguish, because I think what you have said, it's clear that the new organizations, Al-Qaeda, etc. Now, I like to say that, again, that the fight against these networks is not military, or the center of gravity shouldn't be military. It's intelligence, it's communication, it's stopping the amount of money that arrives to them, trying to prevent that they have weapons, etc. Now, let me mention another thing in which the Europeans, I think, we are not aware, or at least we don't have the level of awareness that we should have, which is the weapons of mass destruction. The risk of weapons of mass destruction, and to have these weapons of mass destruction on the hands of failed states or organizations of this nature is a very, very, very serious business. And I don't think that we Europeans are aware of what may happen. And I think we have governments and people begin to think in a different manner about these issues. In a more serious manner. I will divide it in three levels, where we call strategic, tactic, tactical terrorist attacks. I mean, the strategic will be something like September 11. It will be really an operation that it will be very difficult for countries of a level of sophistication to do. It's a very sophisticated operation. A tactical thing we can call like the operation in Bali. It's very easy to do, but it's catastrophic consequences when it happens. And the third level is suicidal bombers, like we have seen in Palestine.
Well, or you could target the world airline industry.
Right, now, how do you fight against that? I think that you have to fight by, as I said before, by communication, by intelligence, etc. And we have to fight also by trying to extract the roots of hatred that still exists in the world. And the roots of hatred are linked to poverty and are linked to the responsibilities that we, the people that belongs to richer countries, we are not willing to take. And we have to take those responsibilities. It's not enough to continue constructing a world without tremendous difference between poor and rich. And when you are rich, the poor will fight against you asymmetrically. And this has been all along history. And now we have more responsibilities, and all the agenda that links with Monterrey, all the agenda that is linked with the United Nations Millennium Summit has to be put in place seriously. And it's not enough to spend money on military only. We have to spend money on trying to solve the problems of this world. Otherwise, we'll have only asymmetric responses. Asymmetric responses, one of the manifestations is terrorism. And we have to face also the, I wouldn't say the causes, because let's suppose that the terrorism is so irrational that it doesn't have any cause. But the atmosphere, the conditions that help of that to happen. And we have to do it, and we, in our own countries, our societies, we have to think that we have responsibilities with others. And if we don't do it, we will create a world that the gap will be every day widening, and it will be a tremendous situation of imbalance, and therefore of insecurity. Because, as I said, these imbalances create asymmetric responses, which are much more difficult to attack and much more difficult to defend. That is the great concern that I have. And we have to convey to our leaders, to myself, and we have to convey to our American friends also, that we have to fight against poverty, against the suffering in the world, all these things that without any doubt are fundamental if we want to get together in a better world. And we are not doing enough. And you know that. That's why when we talk about social democracy, I think that the real values of social democracy today is being internationalist in the real sense. To have these values not only in the dimension of your country, but to bring it to the world at large. And this is, to my mind, the big challenges that we have in front of us.
Yeah, I mean, David Held talks about, Professor here talks about global social democracy, and I think there's something in that. But, I mean, those things are more long-term, aren't they? In the short term, you've got, well, we've now got the issue of Iraq in front of all of us, and we've got geopolitical issues involved as well. And we've got the most threatening thing of all, I think, nuclear proliferation. Is the most threatening thing, really. How does all this homing on Iraq? I mean, what is going to happen in this division between Europe and the United States? How the United States seems to me the current government has just decided that they're going to go to war in Iraq, and nothing that anyone else can do, really, in the world community seems able to deflect them from this. Is there something, or how does one deal with old Europe versus the US and?
Well, I think that we have at this point, as today, a position which is common and shared by all the members of the European Union, I think, which is basically the following. We want to disarm the regime of Iraq, number one. Number two, we want to be done that having at the center of gravity the United Nations, nothing outside United Nations. United Nations is the body in which this dossier should be solved. Third, I think that we have the inspectors, the inspector regime. The inspectors should be our ears and our eyes, and they should be the ones who say to the Security Council, convince the Security Council if the work is being done properly or not, and through the Security Council, convince the rest of the world.
Well, Harvey, can I interrupt you at that point? Yeah. Because, I mean, the inspectors wouldn't be there without the threat of force and the threat of war.
I was going to say that. I think that without the build-up,
how
of
do you
force,
balance those two things?
Right, the inspectors had not been there because we know they were not being allowed. And I want to say now for the European Union countries that it's only one country that has understood that properly, which is yours. And I think we have to pay tribute to yours, because to your country, because you are the one who has contributed to the build-up of forces that has allowed the inspector to return.
Not all of us approve of that.
I think once it has been done, I think we have to recognize that.
Well, I think, yes, the world has moved on. I think there's no alternative.
To do it, because otherwise the inspector would not be there.
Whether
and we
wrongly
could not be
right
talking on this scheme that we have. But the scheme, I think, is clear: disarmament, United Nations.
But can we avoid war?
I think war is inevitable, yes. War is the last resort.
War is avoidable.
I think war is avoidable, and it should be avoided. We have to make all the effort to avoid it. But the responsibility, fundamental responsibility...
Well, what would avoid it? What would avoid it?
I think that...
What should the European Union do? What should Tony Blair do?
I think what the European Union and Tony Blair should do is to, I'm not going to give advice to my good friend Tony Blair.
But this is such a serious situation, I think.
It's a very serious
situation. We need to hear
if it's a problem, because at the end of the day, we have a war. It's a very profound change in many, many things. I mean, Iraq may have many casualties. Before war starts or doesn't start, we may have a crisis in the United Nations. We may have a very profound crisis in Europe. And that's what I would like to call attention to you. We are living in the European Union a crisis, a potential crisis, of the 15 countries plus the new countries, like I never would have imagined that were to take place. If at the end of the day we have the European Union broken, that would be very difficult to fix. The wounds will be very, very, very profound. So we have to make the utmost so that this doesn't take place, it doesn't happen. And you can be sure that I will do everything I can to avoid that from happening. At the same time, we have to maintain the United Nations. And at the same time also, I think that I like to think on these terms, probably not many people think like me on this, the Spectre regime has to be saved. Proliferations of weapons of mass destruction, we are going to have more than Iraq. And we need to have instruments within the United Nations scheme, like the Spectres, so that the only solution to a problem of proliferation is not preventive strike. It shouldn't be preventive strike, the only solution which is left. We need to have mechanisms whereby these problems of proliferation can be solved without the need of use of force.
Would you think it's possible to involve the Arab states at a certain point?
I think it's not only possible, it's necessary.
Given
it's necessary.
That the Americans won't do anything about Israel, or seemingly won't do anything about Israel, how would the Arab states...
But you touch two things at the same time.
I think they're sort of related.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I disagree very much with that opinion.
I think honestly that in the scheme of the last few months, the way in which we tackle the Middle East peace process has been a mistake. I think that we should have put, and in particular, I think we Europeans have done as much as we can, but the United States should have done probably more in order to find, to push a solution to that conflict. I think that the leaders of the European Union keep talking about that. I hope that we will convince our American friends that this is absolutely necessary. We started, and I say that because I was involved on that, on the famous Mitchell report, was done by Senator Mitchell and myself. And we put there everything that at the end of the day will be the solution. We know that. But the solution has not been found.
What could be the solution to the Iraq issue? I mean, could Europe and the US get together with the Arab states to, in some sense, enforce some change?
I will do it in three lines.
Could there be a much more beefed up inspection regime with surveillance flights?
I think first the Europeans have to come to a common position, a strong position in the line that we have taken on Monday. Second, we have to get a better understanding with the United States along the lines of giving time to the inspectors, not an infinite time, but giving time to the inspectors, etc. And third, we have to continue talking as we are doing now with the Arab world. At the end of the day, if Saddam Hussein were to deliver the disarmament, probably the people that can put more pressure, apart from the military one, is the Arab world. And the Arab world can tell him very clearly that the terrible tragedy of war in the Middle East, you can avoid it. And therefore, please
question that we were talking about on the way in, which is kind of crunch question. Two questions, really. Supposing Saddam, under pressure, disclosed certain levels of weaponry, would the Americans not still invade? And second, supposing Saddam said, okay, I'll stand down, but he stood down in favour of a puppet ruler who he would manipulate behind the scenes, what would the Americans do? What would the rest of the world community do?
Well, I cannot tell you what the Americans would do.
These are both quite feasible strategies.
I think we have to send to Saddam Hussein two messages. One, you have to disarm. Second, if you disarm, war will be avoided. And I don't think that Saddam Hussein believes that even if he disarms, the decision of regime change has not been taken. But Resolution 1441 doesn't talk about regime change. It talks only about disarmament. And therefore, we have to continue on the logic of 1441 and not on the logic of regime change.
Well, I was going to say, I hope everyone here shares our hope that war can be avoided and an outcome can be produced which is along the lines that you're suggesting. And I was hoping to have time for questions, but I think unfortunately we do have time, so could you just please show your appreciation of Habib Solana coming here today. Thank you very much. I have to ask you something. Can I just ask you something very mundane? Could you leave by the side entrances rather than the front, because there's another lecture class of 1,000 people trying to come in the front, apparently.